Midlands today on Midlands 103 with Tullamore Motors, the all-new Renault Megane. Feel the drive. TullamoreMotors.ie. When people in the Midlands want to talk, they talk to Will Faulkner.
Well, good morning. How are you on this Wednesday? A lot to get through between now and 12, including why talks still continue to agree climate emissions targets and why agriculture remains the sticking point. Our rape laws are changing. You will have to show that you objectively believed you had consent. How do you prove that? And, awfully, go hunting for a new senior hurling manager after the county board opted against reappointing Michael Fennelly. Is there an obvious candidate for the top job? Plus, you meet members of the Royal Jordanian Falcons. The who? Well, I shall explain very, very soon. And with thanks to a taste of leash, you will sample some fine cuisine from around the O'More County if you become caller of the day. And to do that, you need to pick up that phone and ring 0818 300 103, or you can text or WhatsApp if you're in work. Send a sneaky message to 083 3010 103, powered by Lamb Brothers Toyota in Tullamore. What have we got on the front pages for you? Well, the Climate Action Plan takes centre stage on the Irish Independent. It says the plan must wait as ministers squabble on deal. So there were discussions late into Tuesday night, indeed into the early hours of this morning, and by all accounts they are still talking ahead of the cabinet meeting, which is getting underway around now. And in a deadlock, Environment Minister Eamon Ryan, representing the Green Party's interests, Agriculture Minister Charlie McConnellogue on the other side, trying to keep the reduction in agriculture to a minimum. And he's under pressure from not alone Fianna Fáil backbenchers, Fine Gael backbenchers as well. And he knows the opposition will give him the boot if he gets this wrong. That being said, Sinn Féin have not said by how much agricultural emissions should be cut if they were in charge. And there's obviously pressure on them to spell it out. We'll be contacting a number of Sinn Féin TDs here in the Midlands to see if they have an answer. Overhaul of rape laws to focus on issue of consent. That's the main story on the Irish Times, which tells you that somebody accused of rape will have to show that their belief they had consent was objectively reasonable. Prior to now, they had to say they honestly believed they had consent. Now it has to be objectively reasonable. Why does the wording change? What will it mean in legal terms in court? Presumably, you'll have to recall the conversation very clearly. And especially if it's a one-night stand and there's drink involved, let's be realistic, that's easier said than done, recalling what happened. The main story on the Irish Daily Star. Indeed, you'll see this man's picture on most of today's newspapers. Serving Garda Paul Moody, who carried out a four-year campaign of threats and harassment and assault and coercive control on his terminally ill partner. Just let that sink in. He has been jailed for 3 years and 3 months. Monster Cop is the headline on the Star. Now, let's look inside the papers. Judges obviously have to deliberate on their decisions, and they will look at case law and precedent and what has happened in the past, what their colleagues may have decided in similar circumstances. And you might imagine they go into the vast annals of the law library and they pull the books off the shelf and they try and find some record that is accurate. No, it seems they go on Wikipedia. Believe it or not, researchers from Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Maynooth University created 154 articles on Irish Supreme Court decisions, half of which were uploaded to Wikipedia, and they discovered that many cases quoted, maybe not word for word, but certainly quoted the essence of what was in the Wikipedia article. And it was clear to them that while it wasn't cut and paste, the judges definitely were referring to Wikipedia. And you might say, why not? Except anybody, you, I, anybody who may not have legal training can go on to Wikipedia and create an article or modify an article. And the difficulty is, as Dr. Flanagan, the researcher, Dr. Brian Flanagan, professor of law, he says, if you were defending somebody, you could, at a very early stage in proceedings, give your slant on a previous decision, put it on Wikipedia, and the judge may well refer to that, reaching his or her verdict. You would imagine they'd be a bit more intensive in their studies and in their research than just going on to Wikipedia. Anyway, that is on the front of the Irish Independent this morning if you wish to read more. Now, Buzz Aldrin, famous man on the moon. The jacket he was wearing, flying to and from the moon, has been sold for guess how much? $2.7 million, according to Sotheby's. This is the white jacket which had the stars and the stripes, the American flag, NASA's initials, and then the patch for the Apollo 11 mission. It's all part of a collection that 92-year-old Mr. Aldrin has put up for sale. And he is the last living member of the Apollo 11 crew. So it is incredibly valuable. The total for the auction, and there were 68 items sold, $8.2 million, including $800,000 for a flight plan. Incredible stuff. Now, it has been speculated for the last 2 years or more, did COVID-19 come out of a lab, or did it really originate in an animal market in Wuhan? Well, according to the journal .ie this morning, two studies, two separate independent investigations, have concluded it was a natural virus. It really did happen when, in the Huanan market in Wuhan, there was some animal at which the virus had taken residence, and then it jumped across into a human, and then it spread from there, and it caused all the chaos from around the world. Some people will never believe it, and I'm sure the studies are always going to be limited by how much cooperation they receive from the Chinese, and the proximity of a lab is always going to be a contentious point. Anyway, if you want to read more, it's on the journal today. A civil servant from Dublin is on his way to becoming a Countdown champion. Countdown is on telly for the last 40 years, and only once before has somebody from Ireland won it. We're looking at 85 series winners. And this gentleman, Edward Byrne, only 26 years of age, from Dublin, is vying to be number 86 on the winners list. He has become an octo champion, so he has won all eight of his matches. He practiced, and I didn't know there was a website online that you could practice for Countdown, but he says apparently all of the champions use this. And you can go on and you can simulate what the actual game involves. And by the way, if you're curious, that website is Apterous, APTEROUS. It mimics the structure of Countdown, but it states on the homepage it is definitely not Countdown. But it's a bit of fun. Apterous. So best of luck to watching Edward, and whether he becomes only the second Irish person to win the series. For the record, another Dublin man, Mark Murray, was the first champion, and it took until 2014 for an Irish man to prevail. Weather-wise, over the next few days, mixed. The bank holiday is going to be a bit warmer than it is now. It's slightly cooler for the time of year, a little below average, the temperatures. And, well, Light winds for most of the week, but mixtures of cloud, sometimes sunny spells. That sort of that box of chocolates, you don't know what you're going to get type scenario. But a final story for you from a new poll. What is our favourite scent? And half of people agree on this one. It is the smell of bacon sizzling on the pan, followed by freshly baked bread, coffee, rain on the street, and roses. Definitely agree on the bacon, especially if you've had a few the night before. A good fry-up when you're hungover, you cannot beat it. Other popular but rather unusual smells included. The smell of wet dog, I don't get that one. That is not a pleasant smell. Smell of tennis balls. Do tennis balls have a smell? Never sampled it. Blue cheese. Ugh. And some people love the smell of deep heat. Ooh. Oh yeah, that's what you rub into your legs when you're a bit sore. Well, you're going down a strange road there. I know people who love the smell of petrol. Then again, sniffing petrol is not a good idea. So what unusual smell are you fond of? 083 30 10 103 on text and WhatsApp, or are you like half of people responding to this survey? Is it the smell of a rasher sizzling? Well, I love the smell you get off a new baby, says Avril. Is there a new baby smell other than nappies? Anyway, thanks, Avril. Will, the smell of apple tarts baking in the oven. Oh, yes, Jackie, I definitely like how you're thinking. Smell of garlic, Will. Ooh, well, that's a bit like Marmite. Some will agree with you and love it, others no. Phil in Castle Pollard is one of many people to suggest the smell of fresh-cut grass. I'm with you there. That's very synonymous with summer. Always a good feeling. And, oh, one says, well, the tennis balls certainly have a smell when they're brand new. So like all Lee Rhodey, you have to keep them fresh. Hope you're in good form. The smell of freshly laid tar is something Martin Rattigan in Moat loves. Well, to each their own. I think I'll stick with the rashers, which was top of this survey. Half of people agreeing that bacon sizzling on the pan is their favourite scent. Now, still to discuss today. Justice Minister Helen McEntee changing the rules on rape defence, that you cannot just have an honest belief that you had consent. You will have to be able to objectively prove that it was a reasonable belief. Now, that may sound like techno-mumbo-jumbo, but in practice, how is this going to work? We discuss after 10. Back to climate change. And the Environment Minister says he's hopeful Cabinet can agree on an emissions reduction target for agriculture today. A decrease of between 22 and 30% must be set under the Climate Action Plan. Last night, the leaders' meeting concluded without getting a figure nailed down. However, on his way into Cabinet today, Minister Eamon Ryan says he's keen to get it done in the coming hours.
I hope we can close the difference and agree the approach today. This is very significant for every section of our society. And we've got to make sure that changes we make are for the better. Good for farmers, good for transport, good for energy, good for employment, good for protecting us against the cost of living. So it's taking a bit of time, but I'm hopeful we can get agreement today.
Last week we heard from the Irish Farmers Association. They're prepared to swallow the 22% if it comes to it. But will 22% satisfy the Green Party? Barry Cowan is a Fianna Fáil TD in Laois Offaly, but he's also a former Minister for Agriculture. Barry Cowan, good morning.
Good morning, Will. Former Minister for Agriculture for 2 weeks only, so it hardly constitutes the sort of experience you intimated with the insinuated with that lead-in. But anyway,
well, my point being, it could well be you sitting across from
it could have been
Connolly.
A contender, yeah.
Mm. Well, if you were sitting across from Eamon Ryan rather than Charlie McConlogue doing it, what approach would you take?
Well, look, you have to go back to the programme for government and agreeing a programme for government with the three parties involved was never going to be easy. And we all had our demands and we all had to negotiate and ultimately arrive at a consensus on many issues, and this was one issue which proved very difficult. But nonetheless, agreement was reached. It was a very aspirational demands placed on government and on society by virtue of the commitment to get 51% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2030. That was backed up by committing to legislation which would enshrine the climate action plan contained within that carbon budgets and sectored ceilings. Now we're at the crossroads now in relation to sectored ceilings, but we did specifically reference in the programme for government the special economic and social position of agriculture, and question marks too were mentioned around the classification of methane, which in itself I think was a fair indication of the need for all parties, including the Greens, to understand that we wanted to bring farmers, their reps and the industry with us, not kicking and screaming, but united with clear, achievable goals. And that clear, achievable goal, which a chief inspector in the Department of Agriculture said would take transformational change, is even at the rate of 22%. And as I said, prior to agreeing a programme for government, if you were to talk to anybody in the farming sector or fraternity and talk about those targets, they might not well have believed that they were not possible. So that's the extent of the commitment that they are making. And that's in the expressed knowledge that I and others have of the special economic and social role that I mentioned that agriculture has. It's the, you know, it accounts for 60% of our manufactured exports. It accounts for 38% of all exports. It's 11 billion euro export industry made up of dairy products for 5 million, 2.5 million in relation to other foods, and 3.5 million in relation to livestock, and meat products. So we can't treat that in a way in which is not one which is all-inclusive, is not one which brings everybody to the starting line together and commits to achieving those targets. And government then plays its part in rewarding those that achieve those targets, in even bonus rewards for those that exceed it, and penalties, unfortunately, for those that don't. And that's the sort of carrot and stick attitude I think is necessary to achieve the sort of results which will ensure that this country and the magnificent product that it has always had in relation to food and drink industry in relation to its exports can continue to have. So in other words, we need production systems that align with consumer sentiment and consumer demand, but also align with environmental ambition. And agriculture has a huge role to play, the most challenging role of all sectors, I do believe, but one which that industry and those families associated with it throughout the country, in this hinterland and right throughout the country, as I said, are committed to, are interested in, and want to ensure not only that they're custodians of the land, but they hand the land over to the next generation in a way in which systems allow for us to recognise the need to meet the demands placed upon us in order to ensure that climate action is successful.
Here's how it's presented on the other side, though, that if agriculture does not go far enough in cutting emissions, then it places a greater burden on households, for one, other industries, the energy sector, transport. So how would that be shared?
I accept that. I acknowledge that. And I know transport commitments could be up to 80%, energy likewise. But if I look at the performance on the energy side in recent years, unfortunately, it has been a disappointment. And again, if you go back to the programme for government, when a commitment was made at that time and committed to by the parties in government to move towards offshore wind energy generation to the tune of 5 gigawatts by 2030. You know, in the meantime, we've had the pandemic was far greater than we expected in relation to its length of time and its implications on supply chains throughout the world. And of course, the war in Europe has had another unfortunate impact on the provision of energy and the cost of energy. So, you know, we need to revisit that commitment. That should be much more ambitious. It should be up to 30 gigawatts. There should be emergency legislation to cater for a much more streamlined planning system to cater for the windfall that can accrue from offshore wind development.
Isn't that one of the limitations of wind, though, that can compensate
other sectors where commitments were made in recent years also.
isn't one of the limitations of wind that it produces energy, obviously, while the wind blows, and then when it slackens, you need these peaking plants on standby. And there is only so far you can go reducing emissions through wind alone. What other alternatives, such as anaerobic digestion, could you get behind?
Yeah, again, you know, we have failed to have adequate infrastructure in place that caters for the very predicament you mentioned. When there is excess wind, AirGrid and the CRU and the department have not provided adequate opportunities and competition whereby battery systems are in place to meet that opportunity. Infrastructure in many parts of the country, again, are not sufficient to meet the capabilities that could be derived from developments in the northeast and the northwest as well. So that again is a failure on the part of that sector and those that govern it. And I spoke here before about the failings of in relation to adequate competition being created in the energy sector, which in itself has left us with a monopoly which has been it's been exploited and left wholesale prices far more north than they should have been. And that's before any energy crisis in relation to the impact that Ukraine has had.
But the question was about the alternatives.
The alternatives. Yeah, again, on-farm renewable projects that can be progressed, that can be initiated in government schemes to allow a greater take-up and advantage by the farmer fraternity is something that has to be explored and I expect will be contained in any proposals that emanate from these discussions. And that would cater for solar, that would cater for anaerobic, that would cater for wind, that would cater for all those opportunities on farms. And as it presently stands, the calculation associated with those developments is categorised under energy sector. I think it would be far more beneficial if that were categorised under the agricultural heading.
Can I just clarify that? So are you saying that if a farmer decides to embrace solar, for instance, and they're no longer going to have animals grazing, that it doesn't benefit the agricultural sector's calculation?
It doesn't, no. It's categorised under the energy provision, which is unfortunate, but is one which the farming community recognise that their commitments in that regard is in addition to the 22% target that they're prepared to work towards. So that's movement on their part. And I think if the government was of a mind to allow that categorisation, it would equate to maybe 24%. And that is somewhere we could land. And as I said, I'm just interested, as you know, because of what we've seen in relation to just transition with the acceleration of decarbonisation in this region, and the need to be together, to be united, to be at the starting line together, and to know exactly what can be achieved and how it can be achieved and the benefits of that achievement is something I think is possible at that rate. And we don't need to be at loggerheads. We don't need to be acrimonious. We don't need people on different pages or different starting lines, because the morale is vital here to ensure that there's a result that we all want to take benefit from.
And if there isn't a decision today, then you're looking at a couple of weeks, no doubt, where this debate plays out on this programme and others between your party, the Green Party, Fine Gael, of course, chipping in, maybe the opposition declaring what their position would be. Are you any more likely to have consensus by September than you are today?
Yeah, well, my fear was always when this issue was mentioned in the Climate Action Plan, whereby a range was mentioned for the agriculture sector, amongst others, but if we hone in on agriculture and the range was between 22 and 30, that would automatically lead one to believe that the potential was there for a horse trade and you arrive at 26% and that's supposed to satisfy both parties. It might satisfy both parties, but it doesn't satisfy the sector, doesn't satisfy farm families or representatives or the whole fraternity. So, you know, it might well be best for all concerned that a decision in this regard ultimately come in the autumn, when our respective parties can participate and take greater ownership of any solution that would have the backing of the three parties then. That might not be possible were government to insist on a solution today which didn't have that sort of universal approval that one would like to see. And if that delays things by a month or two, so be it, because it's imperative, as I said earlier, that everybody is on the same page, is at the starting line together, knows where they're going, knows how they're going to get there, and the morale is there to augment their efforts.
So Charlie McConlogue is the person who's doing these negotiations. Have you or your colleagues given him a bottom line number that he should not go above.
Yeah, we've asked him to remain firm in his efforts to maintain the rate at 22 in the knowledge of those on-farm renewable projects also being an addition to that, but calculated presently under the energy heading. And we felt that that was a fair and appropriate landing point then. You know, I'm open to a sectoral forum containing, you know, the stakeholders, whether it be the farm organisations and their representatives, Climate Action Advisory Council, and political representatives to monitor progress over a regular period and to review after a two-year period. As I said, that there should be reward for those that can achieve the target, a bonus for those that exceed it, and, you know, implications for those that don't. And I think that's the fairest way in which this can progress. As I said, there are 163,000 people employed in farms throughout this country. There's 137,500 farms in Ireland. You know, this area, this hinterland and this constituency is dependent, as it has been for generations, with the largest indigenous and industry, which is farming. And I've no doubt that it is up for progress in this matter. It has, you know, it is engaged in many new schemes over recent times that need to be expanded and more appropriate to the needs that are out there in relation to grass swards, in relation to, you know, urea as a fertilizer, in relation to various genomic schemes.
The Green
Party, of course,
we
have technology moving at pace too, and I think that could play a major role in reducing methane, and especially conscious of the Irish red seaweed as an additive into foodstuffs. I know we have a grass-based system, but we're going to work with the pharma industry to devise a mechanism by which that can infiltrate our animal stock and have a far greater positive impact on this debate and on the solutions to this issue.
One final point I'd like your view on. The Friends of the Earth Chief Executive Oisin Coughlan said last night, "It wouldn't surprise me if the Greens were prepared to fight an election on this issue. I doubt those Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael backbenchers looking for further concessions for agriculture are that keen on an election." He's right, isn't he?
No. You know, the term of this government was 5 years. The Green Party, like Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, made commitments. They made commitments to reduce greenhouse gases by 51%. They've enshrined that in legislation, as was contained in the programme for government. They've committed to carbon budgets and have committed to agreeing sectoral ceilings across the various sectors. The agricultural sector is one of those. There isn't agreement on it yet. One would have hoped there would have been. There will have to be. And we're all entitled, you know, and I as a politician have to listen to the experts, have to listen to my constituents, have to make a judgment in relation to the role that agriculture can play in our economy, but also the role it can play in improving our response to climate change. And I'll do that in a way in which meets with my colleagues. We're a party of scale, from different locations and backgrounds throughout the country. We believe we have a contribution to make. We're committed to being in government for a 5-year period. We're committed to making sure that the industry can respond appropriately to this, and we won't be browbeaten by 12 members of that government when 70 others exist. And as I said, it might be best for everybody concerned if this will put back to September, when those respective parties can have a far greater participation in arriving at a solution that meets with everybody's approval.
Barry Cowan, thank you very much for joining us.
$2.7 million for a jacket?
Well, it might be worth it if it was worn by Buzz Aldrin flying to and from the moon. It's one of a number of items to have gone under the hammer at a Sotheby's auction in New York. Seanie Morris is here from the Midlands Astronomy Club. Not the only interesting item in this auction. Good morning.
Good morning. No, there were 67 items altogether from his personal collection. But one of the ones that caught my attention was the story behind the pen and the circuit breaker.
Go on.
This is when himself and Neil Armstrong had done their extravehicular activity, came back up, and after they discarded the portable life support suits out onto the surface and took off their own spacesuits, they realized, On the floor was a little black switch, this little circuit breaker. And as they scanned the wall of the cabin to see what it was the circuit breaker to fire the engine to get back off the moon.
Oh, wow.
This thing is only the size of the top of your thumb, and that was what was going to get them off the moon. So at the right time, that circuit breaker had to be pushed back in to fire the engine. What were they going to do? Well, they decided to sleep on it. Mission Control didn't have a solution when they woke back up 6 hours later. So when the countdown happened, Buzz Aldrin decided the easiest thing to do was take the felt pen from his pocket, and at the moment the clock hit zero, push in the remnant of the circuit breaker to fire the engine. And he managed to bring that circuit breaker and the pen back home, and it was in his personal collection ever since.
Oh, wow. I'd love to know what they went for.
I don't know. Sotheby's haven't given a complete list just yet. You can see the photographs of what was to be sold, but they haven't got the list of what's sold at what value yet. And I'm looking to see what the video might be, because for the jacket, it was an anonymous bidder over the phone that outlasted the others for nearly 10 minutes live in the room to settle at just under $2.8 million. It was, that's the highest value ever paid for a piece of space memorabilia.
There were three men on the flight. Buzz Aldrin is the last one left.
Yes.
92 years young. What has he been up to?
He retired. He's essentially retired, but I do follow him now and again on social media. He does very few public events. He can't take it anymore with the energy involved. But he does a lot of signing. You know, you can buy signed prints from him. He'll, engage online. He still writes books and, we'll sign copies of those too for a nice pretty penny.
Right. Well, we will get more information as Sotheby's released the detail of how much each item went for. We know what you're looking at.
Yeah.
Another interesting one, the flight plan went for $819,000. Who buys these, by the way? Are we talking billionaires off in Dubai? Museums?
Just collectors. I actually have a replica of that flight plan at home. It was given to me as a gift in an Apollo box set. And it's, the actual envelope with the stamp on it is worth a lot of money. That came from Richard Nixon inviting him to a reception at the White House. That sold another time before for tens of thousands of dollars, and all it was just a stamp and an envelope. You know, there are people who just love this kind of, it's a different form of Americana. It's a different form of that kind of nostalgia,
and it's an investment. It's only going to go up in value.
Exactly.
Like you can't get another one.
Yes, you won't ever get that again, and this kind of feat will never be replicated again.
Shawnee Morris from the Midlands Astronomy Club. Thank you. Lots to get through today, including Helen McEntee, the Justice Minister, reforming the laws around rape. And we'll go into the detail of how after 11. Also, the Offaly Hurlers in search of a new manager. Is there an obvious candidate for the job? And the Royal Jordanian Falcons, the national aerobatic team who will be performing in Birr this weekend. Incredible aerial displays being promised. And I'll tell you more at 11:30. Plus, a chance for you to get a taste of Laois with some stunning restaurants, including the Charter Bar and Eatery in the Midlands Park Hotel, the Cedar Rooms Bar and Restaurant in the Collection, the Grain and Grill Bar at the Maldron in Port Laois, and O'Gorman's in Kilminchie, as well as O'Gorman's of the Bog Road. That's all on the way between now and 12. So, here's an interesting study. I think this is fascinating, by researchers at Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Maynooth University. And they've looked at whether judges rely on Wikipedia when composing their judgments. And, well, let's find out what the answer is. Brian Flanagan is Associate Professor at the School of Law and Criminology in Maynooth. Brian, good morning.
Will, how you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So what did you discover?
Well, we found that a judge was 20% more likely to cite a precedent if we had summarised it on Wikipedia. So that's the main finding, because we had an experiment where we could tell the difference between certain cases that we summarized and didn't put up on Wikipedia and paired cases that we summarized and did put up on Wikipedia. And over a period of time, we noticed that the ones that were being summarized on Wikipedia were being picked up in high court judgments and cited by judges in those opinions.
So you created these articles and then watched and waited, in effect.
Exactly. I had 154 articles. We put 77 online. And then we also did it. So as well as looking at, like, you know, which citations were being picked up by judges, we also looked at the language in the Wikipedia summary, like, you know, the entry where it contextualizes the decision it's talking about. And we saw that the language that had been used to describe the decision in the Wikipedia article was being echoed in those subsequent High Court judgments.
So not necessarily a copy and paste, but close enough that you're certain they used your Wikipedia article as a basis for informing their decision.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. So it's like as if you've just read something, you're freshly after reading something, and, you know, it's fresh in your mind, and then you've been asked your opinion on that thing, then chances are your ideas about it are going to be, you know, informed or shaped a little bit by what you've just read, and that there will be linguistic markers of that connection. And that's what we picked up in the words that they were using, the patterns of words that are in those judgments.
Now, you're a professional academic. I'm sure you framed all those articles as objectively as possible. But I presume everything on Wikipedia that is legally related is framed in as down the middle kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue, because with Wikipedia, you know, the potential for anonymity is huge, right? So, you know, these articles are effectively anonymous to the user. So the guy who Googled something, you know, the first hit will often be Wikipedia, but you don't know who's written the Wikipedia article. So, you know, they may have no legal training or legal qualification. And, you know, I mean, potentially they might have an interest in a case that's related to the case that they're writing about. You know, there's that risk. And more generally, I suppose, it's the fact that you don't know where what you're getting is coming from that poses a possible difficulty, because, you know, we're expecting that litigants have, you know, an entitlement to think that when they go to court, that their rights will be decided on by experts and expertise alone. So when a judge looks at a textbook, you know, he's looking at a named person with, you know, named qualifications, or obviously when they look at the source material itself. But with Wikipedia, the anonymity means that that's different.
Well, again, perceptions and reality. So those of us who are not in the legal profession presume a judge will retire to his or her chambers, surrounded by the textbooks you describe, maybe direct accounts of previous cases, and they'll be immersed in that and to try and then reach their verdict, drawing on all those sources. What you're suggesting implies that Wikipedia forms at least part of their investigation. We don't know how much they rely on it, though.
No, well, we can make an educated guess, because if you take those two groups of cases, the ones that were online and the ones that weren't, the ones that were online were 20% more likely to be cited. So that suggests that it's not just a systematic element of judicial decision making, but that it's Wikipedia is actually an important element of judicial decision making. And that might be surprising, but then I wonder if it really is, because, you know, they're human and they're subject to the same temptations the rest of us are. And what we're finding is that the effect only exists, we can only detect the effect at the level of the High Court, not the Court of Appeal or the Supreme Court. And that suggests that, you know, potentially maybe the temptation is stronger at the High Court because, you know, maybe as a court of first instance, the High Court is busier. This is just Mary Irvine, recently retired president of the High Court. She alluded to the fact that the court was so busy and that they could do with maybe, I think it was 17 or 18 more High Court judges. So, you know, maybe there's something to that.
So what becomes of your research? You've raised valid questions, and I'm not sure who goes on to ask or investigate them, or does anybody take this into account?
Well, I mean, first of all, let me say that the research is led by Neil Thompson from MIT, and my co-authors are Dr. Dana Richardson of Maynooth University and Dr. Brian McKenzie Ji-Yong Lau of Cornell University. And at this point, we have we have other papers we want to produce that are related to the one that we're going to upload later today. So the paper we're going to upload will be on the Social Science Research Network, and that's going to be published in the Cambridge Handbook of Experimental Jurisprudence in early 2023. And we're hoping that people will start looking maybe at ways of experimenting on judges and to look for different effects and maybe in different jurisdictions. Ireland was a very convenient jurisdiction for this effect because there had been so few Irish decisions, legal decisions, summarized on Wikipedia when we started our work. So it was easier to get a control group and a treatment group together and be confident that you could compare and contrast. But that wouldn't be the case in the United States. And I suppose the other thing to just bear in mind is that this is part of a broader pattern. Experiments have shown that we use Wikipedia, for low stakes things like, deciding where to go on holidays or things like that, what to do on holidays. And the lead author, Neil Thompson, he discovered that actually scientists use Wikipedia as well. So he found that if you summarize a scientific discovery on Wikipedia, it's not just lay people who would be more familiar with the discovery, but scientists themselves, and they'll do more research based on that discovery if it's been put on Wikipedia. And so the starting point for this research was when that theory had been published and Brian McKenzie at Maynooth and Neil Thompson, they thought, well, okay, could that be true equally of legal precedents?
I suppose the difference and the concern is that in academic circles, it'll be peer reviewed. There's a check and a balance. In the legal profession, well, judges are independent, so if they're making ill-informed decisions, is there any quality control?
No, look, I mean, there's no denying that it is different from science and that this is a situation where we have certain rights. We have the rule of law in the country and the government and the courts are supposed to respect that. And part of that is that when the judge goes to his chambers, he doesn't look at Wikipedia to decide, what precedents to use or to think about how to frame his analysis. And the reason for that is that he doesn't know where Wikipedia stuff is coming from. And so that's true. I mean, it is a problem in a way that it wouldn't be for science, because ultimately a scientific discovery, can be proven on its own merits. But in law, it's different. And what might also potentially happen, down the line, when you have the text of a Wikipedia summary echoed in a later judgment, then there's the prospect that that later judgment could be quoted, and maybe that part of the text could be quoted as the basis for a subsequent legal rule or precedent by another court, so that
it becomes faulty into the future. Indeed,
exactly. Yeah,
it's a fascinating discovery, Brian. Thank you very much for sharing it with us.
Not at all. Thanks for having me.
Brian Flanagan is associate professor of the School of Law and Criminology at Maynooth University. 10:20. He's not Mr. Wikipedia, but he is Mr. DIY. Brian Clunan on the way.